Far above the Ethelduath in the west, the night sky was dim and pale. There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark tor, high up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of the forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever above its reach. His song in the tower had been defiance rather than hope, for then he was thinking of himself. Now, for a moment, his own fate and even his master's ceased to trouble him. He crawled back into the brambles and laid himself by Frodo's side, and putting away all fear, he cast himself into a deep, untroubled sleep.
Cool. Clifford, we're back again.
Yes, we are.
Ooh, it's almost kind of a penultimate chapter of sorts.
A penultimate. No, sorry.
Yeah, you keep trying to add them,
I guess. It is the penultimate chapter to a climax of sorts in the next chapter.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Actually, let's just jump in with Cliff's notes right now,
okay,
and then we'll get into feelings.
Okay, first of all, this is chapter 2,
yes,
book 6,
say that.
The Land of Shadow.
Oh.
Okay, so Cliff's notes. A quick note where we left off. This was Frodo and Sam in the Tower of Cirith Ungol, fleeing, breaking down the magic doors with the File of Galadriel right at the last moment.
And their words.
And the words.
Yeah.
Okay, so Frodo and Sam flee from Cirith Ungol just as a Nazgul drops in from above. In their ill-fitting orc garments, they trek across the Morgai to the desert plains of Gorgoroth, seeking to avoid being discovered in spite of swarming orc armies all around them. It's a short one. That was a quick summary.
What? That was like the first page of it.
No.
Okay, fine. All right,
I would
fine.
Argue that's looking, the whole chapter.
Whatever, don't... Yeah, that's fine, okay. that's fine, because we got to...
More surprises
we're gonna just,
to come.
Yeah, we're going to expand it, I guess, anyway, either way. What? Okay, feelings on this one?
Definitely bleak, like we've been seeing, although we get a little bit of action. This is not explicitly... I felt like this is not the same bleak Frodo and Sam trudging in the most eternally lonesome environment that we've seen them in, like, before. This is the plot is thickening a bit, and they're really, there's some intrigue going on.
Yeah, lots to digest. Mm-hmm. No other way to put it. There's plot stuff, heavy plot stuff all over the place, and then there's also a bunch of symbolic stuff going on, and then we're really ramping up, but there's also adventure parts too, you know, that's adventure as opposed to overall plot, you know, kind of stuff that, do you actually need this? But, but yeah, so let's actually not read the opening scene, because from memory, every single time I read this, unless I diligently, three diligence, pay attention, I get confused what's happening. So why don't you just walk us through what happened?
Sure.
If you can.
So
just that first, like, two pages.
Uh-huh. Okay, so right after they break down the magic door with the File of Galadriel and their words, Sam hides the file and basically yells to Frodo, "We have to run." And Sam had already scouted out the area a little bit. He knew there's a drop-off, but they're basically fleeing out the main door onto the road. And right as they're running, a Nazgul has swooped down and is now perched up on top of the ruined gate that they just ran through, screeching.
Yeah.
So they're thinking the chase is beginning and they're running for their lives. They can't be seen, and yet they're in a totally visible and obvious location in the landscape they don't really know. And Frodo sums it up saying, we have to get off this road somehow. And Sam says, we can't, not without wings. So,
well, so they end up in what part of, on the road?
They're
on a bridge.
Oh, right. Okay. They're on, that's right. Okay. They're on the bridge. Wait, am I confused for a second?
Well, it is a confusing section.
Okay.
So maybe should we look at the map now too? That's the other way to do it.
Sure, sure. That's a good idea. Oh, sorry. I mistake. They first run down to the road, then the road goes over on a stone bridge into the Ethel Duath, over this big chasm.
So there's a little road from Cirith Ungol, like a neighborhood street, mm-hmm. and then it merges with kind of a highway that goes from Minas Morgul to the plain of Gorgoroth, which ultimately to Mount Doom itself. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a highway-ish thing. Mm-hmm. Equivalence, obviously. There's no cars.
Mm-hmm. Notably, it's the same highway that goes down to the crossroads in Asgiliath, where we saw the head in the ground.
Correct, yep. And so they're on that. They're running the wrong way. So any orcs that are running towards the tower, because there's all these alarm bells ringing up, they're going to know you guys are the guys running away. You guys are the problem, mm-hmm. right? So they come to this bridge across this chasm, and they hear that people are coming from the Mordor side, which is from the east. Yes. And then they're running towards the east. Yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. And so the only way to escape that, because there's a Nazgul behind them west at the tower, mm-hmm. is to basically jump off the bridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't even have time to decide. They have to just, I think they dangle down and then they just trust their luck and drop, you know? And when I say trust their luck, we're talking Bilbo kind of luck from the Hobbit.
Right. they do know that they're part of the bridge where the drop off's not as big, but they're expecting to fall pretty far and hard.
Yeah, but what saves their fall?
Thankfully, just a thorny bush that they fall into. So no broken bones, just a bit scratched up.
Yeah, and Sam's even surprised that there's shrubbery in Mordor, but mm-hmm. Frodo starts going on about the mock, evil can mock, it can't make, mm-hmm, you know, so mm-hmm. evil would have to have some sort of living things, right? But anyways, yeah, all of West Mordor is now alerted to them, and they're sitting in this at the bottom of this ravine, because I think they walked the rest of the way down, and they're super, super thirsty, because that was the one thing they couldn't find in the tower was any sort of water.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so then it's at this point, they want to go northwards, right? Frodo wants to for some reason, and so yeah, so let's look at the map.
Yeah, this part's a little bit confusing.
It is confusing because you think north. Why do you want to go north?
Right. He's basically saying, let's walk towards the Black Gate to Morannon instead of walking towards Mount Doom.
Well, so he doesn't exactly say the Black Gate. He says north.
Well, but I should say he wants to go north on the road that leads eventually to the Black Gate.
Right. Well, so it's not a road, really. So it's, all right, so you see you're on the Gondor Mordor one, mm-hmm. right? The zoomed in one? Mm-hmm. So we talked about this last time. That's why I had us pointed out the last time. You see that last ridge on the inside of Mordor? It says Morgai next to it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're in between that ridge and then, like, basically they're in the U of Minas Morgul. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
They're in that ravine there. So this isn't actually even a proper road. I think it's an old riverbed is what they end up saying. And so they're going to walk this way. I guess we'll just say it now. They're going to walk this way because Frodo is actually pretty in tune. And he says, okay, everybody's going to be guarding the east-west route. They're not going to expect us to go north. So this is actually our best chance to just distract people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So he's going to try to cut north away from Cirith Ungol and probably try to get about parallel to Mount Doom,
mm-hmm.
and then cut back over if he can.
Right. On this map, we pass through what's called camp.
Camp.
What's labeled? Is yours list? Do you have a label? Camp.
Oh yeah, no. They're on the other side of that. They don't pass through the camp.
Oh,
they're gonna see the camp.
Right, they see it, but they go near it eventually, right?
All
right,
look at the words Minas Morgul.
Right.
Okay, the U in Morgul.
Uh huh.
That little ridge in between.
Right, right. I got that.
So yeah, they're gonna go up, and they're gonna get to this Durthang place all the way at the top.
Oh. Okay, I misinterpreted that a little bit.
Yeah, I know. It's hard. This is a, all right. The worst thing in the books is the Helm's Deep geography. Uh-huh. The Helm's Deep geography gets me every single time. But then this is probably the second hardest chapter for geography for me. But yeah, I mean, we'll get into it. All right. Let's just keep going.
Okay.
I'll tell you when we hit it.
So, that sounds good.
Yeah. All right. So Frodo, he has the orc mail on. Remember, Sam found all the clothes for him. Mm-hmm. He says it's instantly too heavy. He wants to take it off because there's no way they're going to get to Mount Doom by fighting, so let's just screw it.
Right.
But Sam says, nah, keep it on just in case, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what does Frodo tell him?
Look here, Sam, dear lad, said Frodo. I am tired, weary, I haven't a hope left. But I have to go on trying to get to the mountain, as long as I can move. The ring is enough. This extra weight is killing me. It must go, but don't think I'm ungrateful. I hate to think of the foul work you must have had among the bodies to find it for me.
Don't talk about it, Mr. Frodo. Bless you. I'd carry you on my back if I could. Let it go, then.
Frodo lay aside his cloak and took off the orc mail and flung it away. He shivered a little. What I really need is something warm, he said. It's gone cold, or else I've caught a chill.
You can have my cloak, Mr. Frodo, said Sam. He unslung his pack and took out the elven cloak. How's this, Mr. Frodo, he said. You wrap that orc rag close around you and put the belt outside. Then this can go all over. It don't look quite orc fashion, but it'll keep you warmer. And I dare say it'll keep you from harm better than any other gear. It was made by the lady.
Frodo took the cloak and fastened the brooch. That's better, he said. I feel much lighter. I can go on now. But this blind dark seems to be getting into my heart. As I lay in prison, Sam, I tried to remember the Brandywine and Woody End and the water running through the mill at Hobbit Town. But I can't see them now.
There now, Mr. Frodo. It's you that's talking of water this time, said Sam. If only the lady could see us or hear us. I'd say to her, Your ladyship, all we want is light and water. Just clean water and plain daylight. Better than any jewels begging your pardon. But it's a long way to Lorien, Sam sighed, and waved his hand towards the heights of the Ethel Duith. Now only to be guessed as a deeper blackness against the black sky.
Mm.
All right. So, well, what'd you think of that first?
This sounds like Frodo is you know, in a, kind of a weakened, dejected state. And
kind of yeah. Very much so,
very yeah. much and it feels like he's like basically like he's getting sick, like he's getting yeah. weaker in the moment, he's developing a chill, and Sam is really like fully laying himself on the line at this point, even more so than he has been in the past.
Yeah, the significant things with Frodo, I don't have any hope left, period.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember what the Brandywine looks like, Woody End, Hobbiton. I mean, mm-hmm. that's crazy. I mean, that's like starting to get scary right off the bat, I would say.
Absolutely. And also the yeah. fact that Sam is agreeing to let Frodo take off his chainmail armor and put on the elven cloak that they deliberately packed away so as to yeah. conceal themselves. This is right. like really dejected.
Yeah.
Basically on their wit's end to set aside any sense of strategy to just like basic survival pretty much.
Yep, yep. Okay, so at this point, it's the morning of March 15th. The chapter said it, but what happened March 15th?
Théoden died on the Battle of Pelennor Fields.
So that's the climax. Is at this point in the morning, Théoden was literally laying dead, and the Ringwraith was killed,
mm-hmm.
and Aragorn and the boats are just a couple of hours away. And so Sam notices that the darkness is retreating somewhat, and he says Sauron's not having it all his own way. Actually, he's got some lines here. Let's read this too. Let me see. What did I pick?
Right before this, they note they hear the voice of a Nazgul, but it no longer held any terror for them. It was a cry of woe and dismay.
Yeah. Sam goes on. He says, "What did I tell you? Something's happening!" cried Sam. "The war's going well," said Shagrat, but Gorbag, he wasn't so sure. And he was right there, too. Things are looking up, Mr. Frodo. Haven't you got some hope now?
Well, no, not much, Sam, Frodo sighed. That's a way beyond the mountains. We're going east, not west. And I'm so tired. And the ring is so heavy, Sam. And I begin to see it in my mind all the time, like a great wheel of fire.
Sam's quick spirits sank again at once. He looked at his master anxiously, and he took his hand. Come, Mr. Frodo, he said. I've got one thing I wanted, a bit of light. Enough to help us, and yet I guess it's dangerous too. Try a bit further, and then we'll lie close and have a rest. But take a morsel to eat now, a bit of the elves' food. It may hearten you. So, Frodo, Killjoy, but pretty valid excuse. Mm-hmm. The Wheel of Fire imagery, that's kind of always scary. And he has the one line in the movie that's pretty, pretty, I don't know what you would say, but legit, I guess. all right, so what were the, not what we just read, but the one before, what were the two things Sam was asking for?
Light and water.
Yeah, so they just got the light, is what he said. Mm. But then it didn't actually help Frodo's spirits. Mm-hmm. And so, anyways, they eat some of the light. They eat some of the lambus bread. Mm-hmm. And then they keep going on their way. And so they're going north because Frodo still... He said he only saw one map in Rivendell of Mordor. But he still has a pretty good sense of it, which is pretty impressive, especially given how fatigued he is right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And like we said, they're going to go north because it's the least expected. And so they're going to go north for a bit and then try to cut across this last kind of fence of mountains is how Tolkien keeps calling it.
Mm-hmm.
So they keep going north, and this is the dried out riverbed at this point. And then there's the line, they tried for more than an hour when they heard a sound that brought them to a halt. Unbelievable, but unmistakable. Water trickling. All right. So it's some last old channel of rainwater, I guess, down from the mountain,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And Sam immediately thanks Galadriel for it because it's, what were the two things he asked for? Light and then the water.
Mm-hmm.
And they now have gotten both in the past two things. So we said Galadriel kind of a Virgin Marian figure,
right,
you know,
right.
So this is just another kind of example of that.
Mm.
Even though there's a bunch of, it's always confusing because Elbereth is also Varda, you know,
right,
she's
right.
Also Mary imagery, but yeah, so multiple things going on, but yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sam was he wanted to drink it first, you know, to test it in case it was poisonous,
right.
But Frodo was just not about it. She's we'll both chance it,
right?
And
right,
so yeah,
Frodo at this point I think of is like he's doing the thing where he's like walking forward in a way that he can't stop and he's likely gonna fall, but it's just like it's the only way that he can walk.
You know, yeah,
just like
that's a good point.
Trundling forwards.
I have a history of dehydration, so I guess I could somewhat relate. Yeah, I guess actually, as soon as you mentioned that, yeah, if I was Frodo too, I wouldn't take the chance. It's just like what? Wait, how long?
Uh-huh,
minutes?
Uh-huh.
Definitely not an hour. to see if anything happens to Sam. Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
All right, so they keep going on. Twisted and warped Mordor agriculture landscape scene.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to read it. We don't have time. But it is kind of cool, despite that. You know, so... Actually, well, no, I'm going to say that again later. All right. But they go on until it's probably evening, and they're trying to go up a ravine, because they do try to cut east at this point, right? They think they've gone far enough north that they can cut east. They find, like, a little ravine, and they start going up it. Frodo's too tired, though, and they need to rest. And then we come to probably the first... big passage of the chapter.
Mm.
First big major one. So I'm going to let you start it off.
There they sat and made such a meal as they could. Keeping back the precious lembas for the evil days ahead, they ate the half of what remained in Sam's bag of Faramir's provision, some dried fruit and a small slip of cured meat, and they sipped some water. They had drunk again from the pools in the valley, but they were very thirsty again. There was a bitter tang in the air of Mordor that dried the mouth. When Sam thought of water, even his hopeful spirit quailed. Beyond the Morgai, there was the dreadful plain of Gorgoroth to cross.
"Now you go to sleep first, Mr. Frodo," he said. "It's getting dark again. I reckon this day is nearly over."
Frodo sighed and was asleep almost before the words were spoken. Sam struggled with his own weariness, and he took Frodo's hand, and there he sat till deep night fell. Then at last, to keep himself awake, he crawled from the hiding place and looked out. The land seemed full of creaking and cracking and sly noises, but there was no sound of voice nor of foot. Far above the Ethel Dueth in the west, the night sky was dim and pale. There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark tor, high up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of the forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever above its reach. His song in the tower had been defiance rather than hope, for then he was thinking of himself. Now, for a moment, his own fate, and even his master's, ceased to trouble him. He crawled back into the brambles and laid himself by Frodo's side, and putting away all fear, he cast himself into a deep, untroubled sleep.
All right. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. All right, what are some big things that stick out to you?
Well, the star in the sky after these blessings of light and water. Sounds like
what's the star?
Heavy symbolism. Is it Elendil? The star of Elendil?
Oh, so close, Clifford. Arendil.
Sorry, I always make this. Star of Arendil.
That one's actually pretty fair to screw up because you could Freudian slip that one easily you know. But yeah, so Arendil's star, what is that?
That's the star that Arendil turned. He's the mariner who sailed forever and eventually just sailed into the sky and became a star.
He sailed to Valinor, and then they said to get help because Morgoth had completely overrun Beleriand.
Right. Okay.
Right. So Morgoth had basically won the Silmarillion battle, basically, not the Silmarillion, this story. Mm-hmm. All right, but Arendil gets away half man, half elf, and he gets over there.
And so technically he wouldn't be able to go there normally, but
He got there because he had a Silmaril, and that guided him through the Enchanted Isles that were usually blocking it. And then he pleads the case. All the Valar say, yep, okay, since you came, we're going to go help. And then they turn his boat into a... He's not allowed to leave because he's mortal, because he's half-elven. And so he chooses to be a full elf because he gets the choice, because his wife asked him to. Mm-hmm. He actually wanted to be a man. But then they take the boat and they say, okay, you're going to guard the Door of Night that we're throwing Morgoth into. Mm. And so you're going to be up in the sky. And so, yeah. So what that star that they're seeing is the
Door of Night.
It doesn't... It's a Rendil ship. But the light of it comes from the Silmaril itself. So they're actually seeing a Silmaril up there. Now, it didn't actually say that, but I think that's what every single person interprets that star as.
Okay.
And the real world thing where Tolkien got the idea was Arendil was in some old English lay or poem or something, and it was supposed to be Venus because that's the Eve star.
Right, right.
It's either out at night or in the morning. I couldn't exactly tell what time this was. Right, yeah, but I thought this somewhat matched up. Mm-hmm. And I think the white light actually matches up too, as opposed to, I don't know, something more yellow or red,
I guess.
But yeah, so anyways, that's, Arendil makes the appearance. It reminds me too of the scene before the tunnel where Frodo and Sam were talking about the best stories ever, greatest stories. Mm-hmm. And he pointed out that the file of Galadriel has light reflected from that star in it, and that's what contained that is what the powerful light is. And he said
it's light that's like reflected on the water that is the liquid in the phial. Is that what it is?
Yeah So it's the water from the pool of Galadriel, but taken when the light of Arendil's star is reflecting on it.
Okay.
So, and then somehow that preserves it.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's cool. And so so what Sam had basically put together there was, man, the great stories never end. And I mean, this scene's kind of proof of it again. I mean, he's already mentioned that, but now it's even more so clear because, yeah, I mean, that is the star, and it's always there watching over them.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, too, the star is a sign of hope for him, period, right? Yeah. The shadow is only a small and passing thing is what he sums it up there. And his song in the tower was defiance rather than hope.
Mm-hmm.
What was the one lyric? Do you remember the one lyric that I thought was the most important there?
I don't remember the lyrics specifically, but we did talk about it as a kind of a sign of hope, basically the same thinking here, that he was recognizing the kind of temporality of Sauron's evil in the context of a greater world of a more powerful good.
The line that summed up the song best was above all shadows rides the sun. Mm. Like you said, we talked about that, how it's the shadows could be Sauron, but above that, there's still a higher power, which is the sun, which is... Joseph Pierce has a pretty good quote on this passage that I just thought's worth reading. And to preface it, he's almost even laying out, like, all right, even if Sauron were to get the ring back, or go back to Silmarillion times, even if Morgoth wasn't defeated at the end of the book, Pierce would still assert that this quote would be true. Tolkien asserts with Christian hope that the final victory would never belong to Morgoth, Above all shadows rides the sun. Samwise Gamgee affirms in the Tower of Cirith Ungol, and Tolkien uses the childlike wisdom of the Hobbit to express deep theological truths. The sun is a metaphor for Ilúvatar, the Allfather, God himself, and the shadow is a metaphor for evil. The final triumph of good, i.e. God, and the final defeat of evil were spelled out by Ilúvatar and the Ainu Lindali at the very beginning of creation. Ainu Lindali, what was that? We're tying all of the things back together.
The song at the beginning?
Yeah. Yeah, the music of the Ainu.
Right, right.
Yeah, all the way back. That was multiple years ago at this point.
Ancient history.
Yeah, that was when we did that. So, but I mean, the one of the main takeaways from that song was Melkor was screwing up all the music, right? Mm-hmm. But Ilúvatar said, okay, even when you do that, I'm going to take up the most climactic things you're doing and everything you're doing ultimately and make it fit into my better song, right? Mm-hmm. So no matter what you do, you're never going to win out. Like, you're always going to be subservient to my greater will. Mm-hmm.
The metaphor of shadow and sun is cool because it's like the shadow can only define itself relative mm-hmm. to the sun, mm-hmm. whereas the sun is a thing unto itself,
right?
And then also, if you just imagine what the sun does to shadows, it's like you just change the angle and it just ceases to exist, or it moves, or something like that.
Now, the whole thing to this, though, all this whole conversation, though, this passage that took place, I mean, very remarkable from Sam's perspective in the heart of Mordor.
Right.
when things are quite bleak, to come to the idea, oh, yeah, no, this wasn't a song of hope. This was defiance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know, just, and then he can sleep untroubled.
Yeah.
Right? It literally says untroubled deep sleep afterwards.
Yeah. So. And I think this is also important that this passage, literally the whole plot is reinforcing that, like, Frodo completely needs Sam as a supporting role for him to achieve his quest. But this is critical. Like, Sam is getting his kind of his hope, his emotional reinforcement right now, even if Frodo is asleep and is totally down and feeling weak and everything and getting weaker. It's super critical that Sam is, like, restored or kind of emerges as the one who's, like, still bringing forward this hope of something else, even if Frodo can't deliver it.
All right, so they wake up. Frodo didn't sleep as easy as Sam by any means. Sounds like he was kind of having nightmares and such. That's the other interesting thing. In the Sam and Frodo storyline, originally, it started out more, well, especially in Fellowship of the Ring, it originally started out Frodo was kind of the perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere around in the middle of book four, it really became Sam's the more dominant perspective, too.
Right.
I mean, that was absolutely true the last two chapters where Frodo got captured.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true in this chapter, too. It's more told from Sam's perspective, despite Frodo being the more ailing, hurting one.
Right,
but
right.
It's almost like we can't even relate to that.
Right. You know? Frodo's entered a new, a much less relatable class where he's struggling with this, like, the weight of the world and more is on his shoulders right now.
Yeah. And it's pretty, it's almost morbid. No, I have no hope at all. There's going to be one point where he says in this chapter, you know, I don't really have any hope that we're going to get there. I'm just trying to evade capture as long as I can. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that isn't the most, by no means the most cheerful thing, and then it's that's hard to relate to, mm-hmm. period. But yeah. Alright. So I believe they're climbing east up this Morgai fence, this last fence of mountains, and they get to the top of it. The winds are coming from the west, which is hopeful because that's where the good guys are, mm-hmm. plus that's where the sea's at, so it might be more fresh or whatever. But mm-hmm. the sea's pretty far away from here. Alright. Anyways, there's a description that's worth a read.
Still far away, 40 miles at least, they saw Mount Doom, its feet founded in ashen ruin, its huge cone rising to a great height, where its reeking head was swathed in cloud. Its fires were now dimmed, and it stood in smoldering slumber, as threatening and dangerous as a sleeping beast. Behind it there hung a vast shadow, ominous as a thundercloud, the veils of Barad-dûr that was reared far away upon a long spur of the ashen mountains thrust down from the north. The dark power was deep in thought, and the eye turned inward, pondering tidings of doubt and danger. A bright sword and a stern and kingly face it saw, and for a while it gave little thought to other things. And all its great stronghold, gate on gate, and tower on tower was wrapped in brooding gloom.
All right, so Sauron, he's taking the bait. He's taking the bait, explicitly said, right? There's some king that's distracting his eye, right?
A bright sword, a stern and kingly face.
Yeah.
This is, at this point, Aragorn revealing himself on the battlefield. Is that right?
Well, I think they're still marching at this point. They're marching. No. It's been a day.
Oh, okay.
Because they went to sleep. So, no, Aragorn's revealed himself on the Pelennor by now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they've started their march, but I think it's only the 16th or 17th, so they probably have not started their march yet.
But Sauron can see into Gondor.
I mean, Sauron's seen he just lost the Battle of the Age.
Right.
Now, Sauron could do another one, but it's still quite the blow to lose that to the king who seems to have the ring.
Mm-hmm.
the heir of Isildur who seems to have returned with the ring, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah, that's the blow. So he's eating up the bait. This is... All right, actually, let me just say first. They look across the plain, tons of orc camps and villages.
Mm-hmm.
Token compared them to insect nests, which I thought was a pretty good token detail comparison thing. Mm-hmm. You know? But it's not even just orcs. There's men, too. And then there's a description of part of Mordor that's further away south. If you look at the Mordor map, there's a lake in it. And around that evil lake is where men are raised basically in slavedom, mm-hmm. or slavery. And his army's bred there, too. And then... this part of Mordor is kind of the industrial or headquarters or for base of operations.
Yeah, because they're basically looking out on a giant, like, burning, smoky desert. Like,
yeah.
Nothing grows here. How can they possibly sustain an army
right.
out of this?
Right.
But it's because it's all, at least I think in Tolkien's description, even, like, we talked a lot about this at the start of the book, how the landscape is a part of the plot. Here, it's like the unnaturalness of the landscape, like its inability to sustain an army like that, and the fact that Sauron is using his slaves and the power that he has to, like, force a different type of activity on a landscape that otherwise wouldn't be able to support it.
True.
Is, like, total symbolism of how he is basically treating people. It's like the landscape is in subjugation to, in addition to the people.
Yeah, and what kind of vibes are you getting from the landscape besides just evil? Don't say evil, but think of comparisons to stuff.
Kind of a Mad Max situation, I'm thinking.
Okay. That's a good one, yeah.
Although Mad Max has, like, a distinctly, like, fun aspect, and I think of this as, like, less saturated.
Yeah, Mad Max is some kind of twisted 80s weird.
Right.
like weird, but yeah, like you said, kind of fun or quirky, but
maybe like the
Mad Max wholesomely deranged.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, and then I just, like, general, like, if you imagine, like, honestly, yeah, if you've ever seen a mine, like a strip mine,
yep,
like,
yep.
industrial detritus, kind of that,
yep.
that type of thing, like, you can't tell what the thing was. It just looks like this, like, bombed out version of a landscape.
Yeah. So listen to this description of the volcano. I don't think I got it as much the last chapter when Sam saw the volcano for the first time, but this time reading through it, honestly, you would usually imagine, especially for Tolkien, where this is basically mythology and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
You would think, oh, this is, like, where Hades would live, mm-hmm. or the blacksmith god forging all the weapons and everything. But You mildly get that, but it was more so, no, this looks like a factory furnace, you know? I mean, this look the heavy industry vibes that, you know, Tolkien hated,
mm-hmm.
but definitely saw in 1900 through 1930s
mm-hmm.
England, you know? I mean, like, that, he saw all this stuff, and this is the, like what you're saying, kind of related to the strip mining stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was getting vibes from that, and then the tower, obviously... Big Brother vibes as well.
Mm-hmm. And actually, how do you think this compares to Orthanc and Saruman's tower? Because in some ways it's very similar, right? Like, we've got a wall ringing it in. We've got this tower sticking out of this, like, pit of industry and fire.
So this one was still too big that it was still veiled in cloud.
Right.
And there's still not any sort of real big reveal yet, which is, well, all right, everybody kind of knows. I'm not going to say it, but everybody knows how, like, the next couple chapters go down. But it's, that's one of the questionable things about Lord of the Rings. And if we have time to talk about it next chapter, we will. But, I mean, it's weird how overarchingly present the Lord of the Ring is. Mm-hmm. But also how just a background threat he also is.
Right.
For the whole thing. So, I mean, you know, we're in Mordor now, and then, yeah, you just get a veiled look at the tower, and it's distracted, but I don't know. So, you know, but like I said, the eye, Big Brother vibes, like 1984 stuff for Big Brother, what I'm saying there. Police state, watching your every move.
Mm-hmm.
Fingers and everything. All right. But you said compared to Orthanc. Compared to Orthanc, yeah, this one's just way the bigger, better version. It's so big that we can't even see it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's also a dimension to it. I think it's so high up in the clouds compared to Orthanc.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have, there's also, you can find it somewhere on the internet. Just look up Barad-dûr compared to real size building things. And I don't exactly know where they're doing this, but it's bigger than the Burj Khalifa, the Dubai tall ass tower. I don't exactly know how they're comparing that, but yeah, I guess it comes out to, actually, I'm not gonna say how high because I don't want to get it wrong, because I would get it wrong. I don't exactly know, but it's something ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is something we probably should have talked about in Two Towers, but I don't know when else we're gonna get a chance. So just to keep it quick though, famous towers in the Bible.
Tower of Babel.
Yeah. So do you see any parallels? Remember any parallels thinking about it?
Building towers.
Well, the Tower of Babel was what in the Bible?
Was it one of the cities that gets destroyed? Well, he was evil. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So the Tower of Babel. So the biblical story of it, and we're going to touch on it here. But we're not going to do like a full conversation because I think it was in the background in his head, but it's not like there's any sort of explicit real references besides towers in general, I'd say. Because we've had a bunch of towers, which is why we should have talked about this in Two Towers.
Mm-hmm.
in the Bible, it's built with cooperation of all the peoples of the earth together.
Mm-hmm.
And they build this great tower, which on the face of it, that sounds like a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they had really bad intentions because they wanted to literally raise themselves up to the stature of God. And to slightly get in the weeds of it a little bit, it's not a coincidence that the Tower of Babel story comes after the flood of Noah's Ark story.
Mm.
Because how do you defend against a flood? Oh, you're up in a tower. That would be very helpful. That's part of the reason. They want to be able to outlast any sort of cataclysmic things like that, right?
Mm.
So basically, ever since the Tower of Babel, towers in Western lit, at least, I don't really know about Eastern lit, have always been bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, until modernity. Now we all build skyscrapers, and it's...
Some people cool, would say they're so bad.
I would actually... Yeah, I would say... So I think glass skyscrapers are pretty boring. I'm starting to get in that camp. Ones I grew up with in Chicago get a pass, purely because I grew up with them. Stone ones can be pretty cool still.
Fair.
Yeah, the glass, especially glass square, or just glass. I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot to be desired.
Agreed.
Yeah, you're the architect here, so.
Yeah, I'll say in general, I think density, urban density, really good thing. Good to build tall-ish buildings, but really tall skyscrapers are almost always an ego contest. By the people building them, and they don't have a lot of functional purpose to be that tall.
Yeah, I mean, well, we already mentioned Dubai. I mean, yeah, I see that place because there's a bike race there every year. Mm-hmm. So I basically visit Dubai every year without going there. And every year I'm just, so nobody watches that bike race. Nobody's on the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Actually, I do blame them because it's good lineup. But I just even wonder, are there even people in this town? Like, what do you need all these buildings in the middle of this desert? You guys have all sorts of space in the world,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Anyways, I don't know. That's skyscrapers. So. Next time you see one and you think of the Tower of Babel, maybe that's a good thing, so that we can build better things. Yeah.
A lot of people think the Salesforce Tower here in San Francisco is like the Tower of Baradur, because it's got these kind of spiky things up at the top that looks like a flaming eye could sit on it. And it's also like twice as tall as every other building. So you see it all over the city.
Yeah. Super prominent. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And it's also the way the windows are designed. It reflects like direct sunlight in the afternoon at like a higher rate than most buildings do. So there's always like glowing sun glare right at the top. So
I wonder if Tolkien had Big Ben in mind in London.
Oh, maybe.
Because that is like a clock that could almost serve as an eye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's kind of an interesting concept when you consider how early he was writing it and like how much it's informed like fiction and fantasy since then.
Right. And I've seen pictures, I think, of some local tower in Birmingham or something, or somewhere around Birmingham, wherever he was growing up at the time. But I didn't look into that too much. All right. That's enough about the towers.
Okay.
Let's keep going.
Okay.
Okay, all right. So, Frodo and Sam, they don't see any way down from this lookout, so they do have to backtrack and keep going north. So that's how they're going to get to this Durthang place, FYI. So actually, look at the map really quick. You see the camp, like you pointed out, mm-hmm. camp? That's where they're at, looking out.
They're at the camp or they're looking out?
No,
the camp?
They're in the Morgai part, but they're even same latitude as the camp.
Gotcha, okay. Up on the ridgeline on the 1,500-foot cliff.
Yeah, yeah. So they're looking out at it, no way down. So we got to go back down into this valley and keep going north to get out until we can find a spot. All right. So Sam predicts, though, obviously, everything's going to get more congested as they go north because that's towards the Black Gate, which is quite the hub of traffic, all things Mordor. Right. So they go mile north on the path and they come to some kind of orc stronghold mm-hmm. thing. And it seems like they actually get past it kind of no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But then 2 or 3 miles past that, and they're walking up and they're still hiding from the main path this whole time. They hear 2 orc voices coming up. And the book says, as usual, they were quarreling.
mm-hmm.
They were using the common speech because they're different breeds. Which I think is just such a convenient trick Definitely. For the hobbits to be able to, you know, and understand what's going mm-hmm. on. But one of these guys has a literal big nose because he's a scent tracker.
Uh-huh.
And so he's been tracking Frodo and Sam, but 20 paces away from him, somehow he's now entirely lost the scent. Is that a bad plot or is that just the providential luck as usual, you know? So... It's a lock. we're not going to actually read this orc conversation because we've actually already had enough. We've already had enough orcs.
Yes.
In orc conversations in this book. That's what I remembered from whenever I would read this conversation when I get to uh-huh. this. It's like, this is like the 4th orc conversation.
Yeah.
3 books.
That they all follow the same pattern, right? You've got like two guys who are petty. They don't trust each other. And... they're from different companies. They disagree with the power structure that the other one's trying to present, and they end up fighting about it.
Yep, absolutely. All right, what were some key details that came out of this one, though?
They share a little bit of gossip. One, yeah. that there's an elf with great bright armor, and then potentially there's a small dwarf man or something. We can assume the elf with the bright armor is the noble Sam charging into the Tower of Cirith Ungol, right?
Oh, you think? Or was it Frodo? Because Frodo had the Mithril vest.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But maybe not. Maybe not, because they have the Mithril vest. They're not worried about it.
They did think Sam was an elf warrior when he was charging up the stairs. Yeah. And then they also catch that maybe the battle isn't going so well.
So I think they actually said battles. They pluralized, I believe. Yeah.
There's reason to be hopeful.
Yeah, one of them was actually rooting for one of the Nazgul to be dead. He was rooting for it.
Yeah.
He says he hates them so much that, yeah, I hope it's true.
Yeah. And basically they say they've done in number one, I've heard, and I hope it's true.
Yeah.
Number one being the biggest boss, the head Nazgul.
Yeah.
And then notably, they also mention what messed up the trail, the smell of Frodo and Sam, is a little stinker creature who we know to be Gollum.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh. Yeah, all right. So, Gollum.
Gollum is back. Just when you thought you were done with him. Sounds like he's returned.
I can't really hide this one. Everybody knows Gollum was coming back. Mm-hmm. But it's better than... That's why it's better than what the movie did. The movie had him fall off some cliff. Crazy. That's ridiculous. But they also found Frodo's male shirt that he dumped. That was part of the reason why we actually read that section. Mm. Was because Frodo dumps the orc male shirt and they can smell the scent on it. So that was kind of dumb of them. Mm-hmm. But especially when you got orcs that have big noses. Mm-hmm. But whatever. Can't blame Frodo, I guess. All right. The smaller one, though, he breaks out his bow and he kills the bigger one because they're fighting so much, right? Mm-hmm. And then the smaller one just disappears. So Sam says, if the orcs keep quarreling like that, literally half their work will be done. Mm-hmm. In Mordor. And Frodo explicitly says, yep, that's the way orcs quarrel. But don't put your hope in it, because they hate us even more. Mm. If they spotted us, they would have instantly dropped their quarrel and united to kill us first, right? So mutual hatred, kind of famous, a famous way for fallen human beings and orcs to forge alliances, right? The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of exceptional when some sort of alliance isn't mutual hatred of something else is not at the heart of it,
you know? right It's a very strong motivator of union, or I shouldn't say it's a very effective and common motivator of unions.
Potentially the fellowship is the outlier, but then again they want to defeat Sauron. But
you could argue there's at least a similar characteristic. Like, why would an elf and a dwarf hang out together, we might ask?
Well, they didn't want to at first, but now they're best buds. So right. Maybe that part was forged. That has eclipsed the mutual hatred. Now they're doing it from friendship now.
Fair enough.
And the idea of the fellowship was pretty selfless, because they probably figured they were going to die doing it too.
Fair.
I don't know. I buy it. But it's really hard to not have a mutual hatred of something. Mm-hmm. be at the front. And obviously, what's the term for all this?
I don't know.
Scapegoat. Yeah.
All
right. Would you agree, or am I going too far?
No, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. Scapegoating. Most famous scapegoat, well, in the 20th century was probably the Holocaust. So, that they Hitler blamed the Jews for a bunch of problems that Germany and the West were having. Yeah. So that was his.
He leveraged people's discontent with many different things towards one destructive goal.
And then that united the German people to start the Nazi party and go on the offensive too. So that's the thing about scapegoating, is that it's actually pretty effective, which is scary. It was difficult and dangerous moving in the night in the pathless land, but slowly and with much stumbling, the two hobbits toiled on hour by hour northward along the eastern ridge of the Stony Valley. When a gray light crept back over the western heights, long after the day had opened in the lands beyond, they went into hiding again and slept a little, turn by turn. In his times of waking, Sam was busy with thoughts of food. At last, when Frodo roused himself and spoke of eating and making ready for yet another effort, he asked the question that was troubling him most. "Begging your pardon, Mr. Frodo," he said, "but have you any notion how far there still is to go?"
No, not any clear notion, Sam," Frodo answered. "In Rivendell, before I set out, I was shown a map of Mordor that was made before the enemy came back here, but I only remember it vaguely. I remember clearest that there was a place in the north where the western range and the northern range send out spurs that nearly meet. That must be 20 leagues at least from the bridge back by the tower. Might be a good point at which to cross. But, of course, if we get there, we shall be further than we were from the mountain, 60 miles from it, I should think. I guess that we have gone about 12 leagues north from the bridge now. Even if all goes well, I could hardly reach the mountain in a week. I'm afraid, Sam, that the burden will get very heavy, and I shall go still slower as we get nearer."
Sam sighed. That is just as I feared, he said. Well, to say nothing of water, we've got to eat less, Mr. Frodo, or else move a bit quicker. At any rate, while we're still in this valley. One more bite and all the food's ended, save the elves' whey bread.
I'll try and be a bit quicker, Sam, said Frodo, drawing a deep breath. Come on, then. Let's start another march.
All right, so just to add on a little bit here, look at the map. The book says it's this Durthang place is what they're kind of approaching, because mm-hmm. that's at the end of this valley. And this kind of seems like the last outpost of a whole network of forts that aren't listed on this map, though,
mm-hmm.
where the Eisenmouth is the center. Mm-hmm. And the Eisenmouth, they made it sound like, is the armory of Mordor. Everybody's equipped with their weapons. And then the Morianon up at the top is the Black Gate.
Mm-hmm. But now, let's just establish, why does Frodo actually want to go this way? So that gap that he was talking about the Eisenmouth, it sounds like he's trying to stay to the mountains and not go down into the plain.
No, so to get out of this valley, the only way is to go all the way to the Durthang place. Then you take the road, and then you take the road not to Eisenmouth, but you go the other way south back towards that camp place that they were looking at and go to Mount Doom. Also, this is Mordor, so it's a plain, so you probably don't actually have to take a road. You could just walk.
Okay.
that's the thing. They tried to climb over the ridge. That's why they're overlooking the camp.
Hmm.
They couldn't get down because it's the 1,500-foot drop, and it's just that way the whole time.
Okay, I see.
Unless you want to, yeah.
So it's not a strategic decision to go this far north. It's more of a functional constraint. There's only two ways. The main road down by Cirith Ungol, and then this second path up by Durthang and Eisenmouth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tolkien also needed to get the dates to line up, so they couldn't just go the 2-day march.
Of course.
I would actually think he probably actually did it the other way. I think he probably had the Frodo and Sam timeline more so laid out, and then the army had to
take a little time.
Get configured into that timeline. But yeah. But anyways, that's what's going on. The other funny thing to think about too is when they're marching up, Frodo and Sam are pretty close. I mean, these mountains. I'm not gonna guess mileage, but I thought he said it's 40 miles to the mountain from. He said it's 40 miles to the mountain from maybe the Eisenmouth place, right? To Mount Doom? Is that what he said?
Let's see. He thinks it must be... 40
miles still to go?
It must be 20 things at least.
60 miles?
60 miles back to the tower.
All right. Well, so 60 miles to the tower from where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
That means the good guys, Aragorn's army, has to be within like 10 miles marching right past them.
Well, no, hold on. I think he's saying it's 60 miles to Eisenmouth back to the tower, and that it's also 60 miles from Eisenmouth down to the Tower of Barad-dûr.
Pick wherever you want on this plane. If it's 60 miles there, this mountain ridge can't be more than 10 miles wide, is what I'm saying.
Right, absolutely.
So the good guys are going to pass them, and they're 10 miles away from them.
Mm-hmm.
The whole army, you know, it's one of these days,
right? Okay, you're absolutely right, because they're coming up the road on the left side of the mountain ridge, and Frodo and Sam mm-hmm. are on the right.
So let's see. All right, so there's that, but this Durthang tower, this is gonna get in their way, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is too when the book actually points it out that Sauron's armies are massing towards the Black Gate right now mm-hmm. on the Mordor side. So just as the good army's walking up, theoretically 10 miles away, the Mordor army is pouring into the Eisenmouth to get armed and then go to the Black Gate for that big battle as well. So this is all getting even more heavily trafficked than usual. And it's kind of at this point, I think it's a good time just to point out one major thing that we all already know, but it goes unsaid too often. If you look at the show times of these episodes for our podcast, books 2, 3, and 5 are significantly longer than 1, 4, and probably 6 once we're done with it. All right. And because book 2 is the Fellowship, book 3 is the Rohan stuff, book 5 is the epic Minas Tirith stuff, right? So great heroes. Awesome wonders, beautiful landscapes, lots to read, lots to cover. You know, it's all the glories of the West and everything. If you're watching the movies and you're not going to watch the full thing and you're going to skip scenes, you're going to skip more Sam and Frodo scenes than you are Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli scenes. It's just the way everybody does this, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, book 5, as I've said, is top three most epic things ever written in the history of literature. Okay. But this is all entirely part of the intentional irony Tolkien's putting together. Like, he's doing this all intentionally. Like, Aragorn and Gandalf, they're doing great deeds of valor. They're knocking everything out of the park. They're doing such a great job. But at the end of the day, it's a sideshow. Okay. The real journey is, of course, with Frodo and Sam here. These guys are the most important heroes. And what are they doing? They're crawling and creeping kind of like ants. Mm-hmm. I think that's how Tom Shippey put it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not flashy or glorious. It's more just exhausting and hopeless and depressing to where I even have editing abilities. but ultimately, you know, it's these guys that are going to save Aragorn, Gandalf, Minas Tirith, Rohan, Lothlorien, Rivendell, the Shire. They're going to save it all, right? And it's, I don't know. It's just, it's worth explicitly saying that at least once, even though we all kind of know that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with that, they have to get past this Durthang Tower now.
Mm-hmm.
Heavily trafficked road. This is equivalent of like a Mordor highway that they're going to have to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam has some lines here, so let me read it. "Then we must take the road, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "We must take it and chance our luck, if there is any luck in Mordor. We might as well give ourselves up as wander about any more, or try to go back. Our food won't last. We've got to make a dash for it."
"All right, Sam," said Frodo. "Lead me, as long as you've got any hope left. Mine is gone. But I can't dash, Sam. I'll just plod along after you."
"Before we start any more plodding, you need sleep and food, Mr. Frodo. Come and take what you can get of them."
He gave Frodo water and an additional wafer of the whey bread, and he made a pillow of his cloak for his master's head. Frodo was too weary to debate the matter, and Sam did not tell him that he had drunk the last drop of their water and eaten Sam's share of food as well as his own. When Frodo was asleep, Sam bent over him and listened to his breathing and scanned his face. It was lined and thin, and yet in sleep it looked content and unafraid. "Well, here goes, master," Sam muttered to himself. "I'll have to leave you for a bit and trust to luck. Water we must have, or we'll go no further."
All right, so luck, definitely that's kind of like the Bilbo Hobbit luck, right? You mm-hmm. know, luck equals providence, just trusting that. Good actions can kind of seem to influence that.
Mm-hmm.
Generously giving his gift, like cloaks and all his food and water to Frodo, right?
And his hope as well, which Frodo says pretty basically explicitly.
Yeah.
Frodo has no hope, so Sam is basically providing all the hope for their mission.
Yep. All right, so Sam actually goes and he finds water very close by, and I don't know if they actually said it, but I think the rationale is, well, if this tower exists, there's probably water nearby.
Mm.
And so the orcs have some sort of water source, so Sam kind of finds it, and he doesn't even have to go that far. He's probably just barely without it outside of eyeshot of Frodo, I think. And so it's at this point that he turns back to Frodo, but
at that moment, he caught a glimpse of a black form or shadow flitting among the rocks away near Frodo's hiding place. Biting back a cry, he leapt down from the spring and ran, jumping from stone to stone. It was a wary creature, difficult to see, but Sam had little doubt about it. He longed to get his hands on its neck, but it heard him coming and slipped quickly away. Sam thought he saw a last fleeting glimpse of it, peering back over the edge of the eastward precipice, before it ducked and disappeared.
All right, so we know who this is.
Mm-hmm. Gollum returns.
Yeah. And so Sam would basically, he's so pissed, and he says, "I wish he had been shot," right?
Mm-hmm.
And when he says shot, he was referring to Faramir's archers when they were at the Forbidden Pool.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not quite fair, because Gollum kind of did get him to the tunnel, you know, to let him get eaten, right? But then that also goes all the way back to Gandalf's conversation at Bag End, which we talked about multiple times at this point, and it still rings true, though, is it's not really our job to decide when somebody's supposed to die or
mm-hmm.
we're supposed to end someone's life or anything, you know? Gandalf said he figured Gollum had a part to play still. He played that Olive Book for,
mm-hmm.
and seems like it might not be over yet. So Sam lets Frodo know about Gollum, but they both fall asleep anyways. That's the kind of weird thing is Frodo, well, I guess he's so tired and fatigued that he just doesn't even care. I mean, he just falls asleep and mm-hmm. it's just whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they get up and they start to go on, and the book says they were about to start the most dangerous stage of all their journey, which is, well, they went through Shelob's lair.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. A bold statement after all they've been through.
Right, or I just don't believe it. Okay. They fought a Balrog. But, all right, anyways, the guy walked down this road, and the first time I ever read the books, I hadn't seen Return of the King extended edition yet. And so this was a pretty wild part the first time I ever read it. So they had no choice but to just openly walk down this road, right? And if somebody sees him in the tower, somebody sees him in the tower.
Mm-hmm.
I think at least Frodo has the Lothlorien cloak, and then Sam, I guess, theoretically looks like an orc, mm-hmm. maybe, mm-hmm. right? But they're walking along this road, and then they're in sight of the tower. On the one side's a severe drop. I think it's their right side would be a severe drop, and then their left side would be a cliff. And so so there's nowhere to go off the road once they're on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going along, but then after doing some 12 miles, they halted. A short way back, the road had bent a little northward, and the stretch that they had passed over was now screened from sight. This proved disastrous. They rested for some minutes and then went on. But they had not taken many steps when suddenly, in the stillness of the night, they heard the sound that all along they had secretly dreaded, the noise of marching feet. It was still some way behind them, but looking back, they could see the twinkle of torches coming around the bend less than a mile away, and they were moving fast. Too fast for Frodo to escape by flight along the road ahead.
"I feared it, Sam," said Frodo. "We trusted to luck, and it has failed us. We're trapped." He looked wildly up at the frowning wall, where the road builders of old had cut the rock sheer for many fathoms above their heads. He ran to the other side and looked over the brink into a dark pit of gloom. "We're trapped at last," he said. He sank to the ground beneath the wall of rock and bowed his head.
All right, so it really was at this point. I distinctly remember reading this the first time, and I just said, oh, great. How the hell are they going to get out of this one now? Uh-huh. It's just, come on, we're in the heart of Mordor, and we don't have time for this.
Right.
Like, what? But anyways, they kind of figured the best thing to do is just kind of sit side by side on the road, look super tired, and hopefully the orcs just let two soldiers rest.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically their only thinking. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's about the best you could probably do at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So they are subtly very lucky that the orcs that come by, they note, are smaller breeds, because that was always one thing. If you didn't read it closely, you would wonder, how the hell did these hobbits look like orcs? They gotta be too small, right? But if these are smaller breeds, this starts to somewhat make sense. And then there's two massive ones with whips, slave driving them, right? Mm-hmm. So the initial leaders pass because they don't give a crap about anything. They're just trying to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
But then the taskmasters behind see them sitting on the side, and they think they're either slouching or deserting from some previous company or something.
Mm.
So he makes them get in line, where they go at a brisk trot.
Which, as we've heard from previous descriptions of orcs running and are marching, is pretty brutal. Right.
It says, it was hard enough for poor Sam, tired as he was, but for Frodo, it was a torment and soon a nightmare. He set his teeth and tried to stop his mind from thinking, and he struggled on. The stench of the sweating orcs about him was stifling, and he began to gasp with thirst. On they went, and he bent all his will to draw his breath and make his legs keep going. And yet, to what evil end he toiled and endured, he did not dare to think. There was no hope of falling out unseen. Now and again, the orc driver fell back and jeered at them. So, yeah, this is kind of one of those superhuman situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're all over the place in any sort of literature or anything. The first thing that came to mind was, I remembered in Unbroken, Louis Zamperini, he was in one of the POW camps. Yeah, POW camps in Japan, and they had some sort of railroad beam.
Mm.
I didn't exactly look it up. I'm just trying to remember it, but I believe what it was they just had to, it was like kind of a torture thing to just lift this railroad beam above your head, mm-hmm. for as long as you could, and nobody could do more than 3 minutes or anything. But Zamperini, because it was the worst guard, that bird guy, uh-huh. if you remember,
uh-huh.
he was the one that's saying, oh, you got to do it. And so Zamperini was like looking him dead in the eyes the whole time, and he held it for like 37 minutes, uh-huh. until they told him to put it down. He didn't even have to drop it from breaking down. They just said, okay, drop it, you know, but like just crush the record, right?
Uh-huh.
It's that kind of thing that's kind of going on here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. basically like time of intense hardship. Sometimes people are able to channel some other like reserve of power and energy that is not humanly, doesn't seem realistic or logical in any way. But yeah, sometimes people are able to motivate themselves in a different way.
Right. And it's motivated because you have literally no other option. It's either this or basically death or basically death. Right.
Right.
I mean, or that, or you completely fail at everything. So that's what they were doing here. They jog all the way to the Trifork on the map, to the front of the eyes, or well, the Mordor front of the Eisenmouth place. Right. Mm-hmm. That's where they get to. And so the three roads meet there. And then by this point, they've emerged out of the cliffs and they're on a plain. And then do you want to take, you want to start this?
Along all the road, troops were moving, for the captains of the West were advancing and the Dark Lord was speeding his forces north. So it chanced that several companies came together at the road meeting, in the dark beyond the light of the watchfires on the wall. At once there was a great jostling and cursing as each troop tried to get first to the gate and the ending of their march. Though the drivers yelled and plied their whips, scuffles broke out and some blades were drawn. A troop of heavy-armed Uruks from Barad-dûr charged into the Durthang line and threw them into confusion. Dazed as he was with pain and weariness, Sam woke up, grasped quickly at his chance, and threw himself to the ground, dragging Frodo down with him. Orcs fell over them, snarling and cursing. Slowly on hand and knee, the hobbits crawled away out of the turmoil until at last, unnoticed, they dropped over the further edge of the road. It had a high curb by which troop leaders could guide themselves in black night or fog, and it was banked up some feet above the level of the open land.
They lay still for a while. It was too dark to seek for cover, if indeed there was any to find. But Sam felt that they ought to at least get further away from the highways and out of range of torchlight. "Come on, Mr. Frodo," he whispered. "One more crawl, and then you can lie still." With a last despairing effort, Frodo raised himself on his hands and struggled on for maybe 20 yards. Then he pitched down into a shallow pit that opened unexpectedly before them, and there he lay like a dead thing. All right, and that is the chapter's end.
Brutal.
Yeah, so it's all kind of like self-explanatory. There's still Aragorn's army going on in the background, right? But it was this part, I don't know, you know, it's not a stretch to say, ever since Bag End, we've known this ring's getting destroyed, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of those parts where it's like, okay, sure, they're going to make it. But you see this kind of mini adventure come up and it's just, how the hell are they going to get out of this one?
Right,
you know? And
right.
It really is about the hows in the story as opposed to just the final goal, right?
Right.
You know? Because some of these hows like this, it's like, oh, that is actually pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. that was a pretty well thought out escape by Tolkien's writing.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, it's plausible, and then it was actually kind of quick, which was nice.
Right, right.
I don't know. You got any more thoughts about that?
It's funny how it parallels Merry and Pippin escaping from the Orcs before.
Yeah.
Feels like either it's like a paying homage to them or something, or it's something about like how the hobbits that you expect nothing of are able to get by in this world of people who are bigger and stronger and more powerful than them.
Yeah, he does the parallels in the books all the time, and like between like book 3 or book 4, 5, 6, you know, or Merry and Pippin with Rohan and Gondor and stuff. So we try to point those out as much as we could, but then again, sometimes it's just, all right, well, this will just bog down the episode and it's redundant. But yeah, you're probably definitely right that this is definitely a throwback to how Merry and Pippin escaped. I never even thought of that one. Mm-hmm. I did think like when they saw Durthang, it's kind of like the same mountain complex is like when they were staring at the black gate and it's just, oh crap,
when Aragorn and Gandalf and all
when Frodo and Sam were staring
from the other side, that
one's also a parallel when Aragorn and Gandalf are staring at it, because it's like, oh, Frodo and Sam were here, you know,
but
then Frodo and Sam are ironically staring at something that they're now on the other side of, but it's still kind of
weeks back. A long and tumultuous journey to make a big U-shape on the map.
Right, right. it is kind of, sometimes you need that explained that, yeah, they went all the way to this Durthang place. They went all the way up. So slow, but yeah. All right, so we're done with the chapter, obviously. But there's one big conversation I want to hit now, mostly just to slash the length of the next episode, because everybody knows that's the big climactic one.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we're just assuming it's going to be really long. So... So just to get ahead of stuff here, there's one conversation that we've already been building out, but now we're going to explicitly talk about it for the big show, big time.
Okay.
There's basically three. Oh, and that's the other thing. This is going to be heavily biblical, so it's at the end. So if people just want to skip that, no problem. But this is a pretty fun one. So in the Old Testament, there's three significant roles basically every single male character fits into. The women kind of have different roles, I guess. But anyways, the three roles are priest, prophet, and king. Okay?
Mm.
All right. So if you think of anybody, they're probably one of those three. Unless they're like an early patriarch in Genesis, but you could probably call them prophets. All right. For our purposes. So come the New Testament, Jesus fulfills all three of these kind of roles or offices, whatever you want to call them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So kind of famously, probably intentionally, Token plays with these three offices, Christ types, you know, okay. In Lord of the Rings. All right.
Interesting.
So let's start with the king because that's the easiest one. So which character in Lord of the Rings is playing the king role?
Aragorn.
Absolutely. Right. Easily. Yeah.
The king who is returning.
Right. So biblical reference though, Old Testament. Who's the king in the Old Testament?
Solomon.
All right. Good guess. Who's his dad?
David.
So King David's the cream of the crop. Solomon's next best, but he screws up at the end of his life.
And okay,
it's so depressing. Solomon's kind of like the Isildur, where he's a pretty much a rock star, but then pretty disappointing end.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Elendil, Isildur's dad, is like King David a lot. So I don't know if Tolkien explicitly made those parallels, but he subconsciously did that.
Okay.
Because so, Aragorn's a descendant of both of those, just like Jesus is a descendant of David through Solomon through how many generations? Like 28 generations down to Joseph, to Jesus. Okay. So that's the thing is there's 400 years of kings after David of Judah, because the Israel actually splits up, but we don't have to get into that, of Judah. Then they get conquered by the Babylonians, exiled. And when they come back, they're back in the land, but they're ruled by foreigners, so they don't really feel free. And that's for 600 years up to Jesus' time. So when they're awaiting Messiah, they're awaiting somebody to set them free from the bondage, right?
Mm.
And it's predicted that the Messiah is going to be a son of David to bring him back. Unexpectedly, Jesus fits the description because he is the son of David, and he is the Messiah, and he is the king. But he's not the political king that sets him free. He sets him free from sin and death, which hopefully we talked about in the True Myth specials. So if you read the Gospels, one thing Jesus is talking about all the time, he's talking about like the kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he was the one that by dying and coming back to life, he conquers death. He brings about a new age of history. Very similar to Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And you know, hopefully we've talked about it enough in of like the longing for a return of the king in Return of the King.
Mm.
We still got more to talk about because the book's not over. But, you know, already compared to Aragorn, getting the ghost, harrowing of hell, that's kind of conquering death, right? We've talked about that, and like how the hero goes to the underworld and does that. So that one's pretty easy, but just to make sure we're laying it out there, that's that.
Okay.
All right. Prophet. Who's the prophet? This one's pretty easy too.
Gandalf?
Yeah.
Okay.
These are all exactly what you're thinking.
Okay.
You know? Like even if you barely know where I'm going with any of this, you know who fills basically all three of these. So
I was tempted to think Gandalf might be a priest, but prophet
works. So the priest is the hardest part, but we'll get to him. Why is Gandalf the prophet? You tell me.
Gandalf, I think, is foreseeing. Gandalf is basically the one who knows what to do with the ring before anyone else does, right? So I think he's foreseeing the end of this age, the destruction of the ring, the destruction of Sauron, is motivating everyone to do it, and...
All right, well, so I guess we should actually kind of slightly define... Just what do you... Define prophet a little bit, too. because you're doing it right. But
just okay, for, I would for I would that wouldn't know. I would consider a prophet to be somebody who is predicting and kind of alerting other people to the future that they see.
Okay.
That sounds like a weird definition.
Yeah, they're more than a fortune teller, right?
Right, right. They're not just predicting the future. There's there's an element of urgency and of motivation.
Well, so in the Old Testament, the key thing is that they have communication somehow directly with God, almost, right?
Mm.
Like that's a real big thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in Gandalf, you see that pretty heavily, that he's by far and clearly the most trusting to whatever providential higher power is going to see this mission through, right? Especially after so one of the big Gandalf Christ connections is like, well, Gandalf was resurrected, right? You know, and when he comes back as the white, he's even more lofty, kind of clairvoyant, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like tides turned, we got this, you know, and he's I don't know, even more confident, I guess, than he was before. And what we were kind of saying in the chapter 10 of book 5, when they were at the Black Gate, comparing Gandalf to the messenger from Mordor, was Gandalf's kind of like the messenger of the good forces. And when I say messenger, as in like angel, you know? And so the prophets of God are more human people, but Gandalf's kind of human enough anyways to keep doing this comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So prophets, they share a message to God's people.
Okay.
Right? Who is the greatest prophet in the Old Testament? It's objective fact. You can have multiple guesses, and I'll just edit it so that your right one's the right one.
Is it an angel?
No. It's going to be a human. It's a very big name. A very commanding name. Maybe I'll say his name 10 times.
Oh, okay. Moses.
Yeah. All right, so Moses is the greatest prophet for a very explicit reason, okay? So the reason is, between Adam falling to Jesus coming, he's the one, or one that comes the closest to actually speaking with God face to face.
Okay.
So there's a couple of stories in Exodus where there's one where it says he explicitly sees God face to face so they set up a tent where they keep the Ark of the Covenant, which is where the Ten Commandments are,
mm-hmm.
and God comes to dwell and basically sit on top of that. And supposedly Moses talked to him face to face, but it's very hazy whether he actually did or if he then loses his power later if he did.
Okay.
But then there's this kind of comical story where God says, all right, I'm going to show you what I look like, but you can't handle seeing the real me, like all of me, because I'm too powerful and too much for you to handle, right? And so he says, but you can see my backside. So basically, Moses almost like kind of, maybe God actually covers his eyes for him. But anyways, Moses can't see. He closes his eyes. God walks by, and then he says, probably says like, all right, open your eyes, you know. Uh-huh. Moses can see his backside or something. So that's the closest anybody's come to talking face to face with God, until Jesus does, because he's the Son.
Okay.
So the Son can communicate with the Father very easily, you know, because there's kind of the same, how would I phrase that? Do I say essence? Is that biblically or theologically correct? I don't know. Whatever. Anyways, of the many things that Jesus is, he's the new Moses, because he's the one that finally escalates past Moses. And then, at that point, the face-to-face communication with the higher power, Gandalf in Lord of the Rings kind of clearly takes the cake easily on that one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of the good forces, at least.
Right, right.
Maybe Elrond and Galadriel would compare, but they're not as active as Gandalf in this book.
Right.
So, directly.
Right. And Elrond seems like he has wisdom from his age and from being one of the high elves, but
yeah,
Gandalf is like literally bearing the knowledge and will of the Valar in Middle-earth.
Right, right. Yeah, which is something we'll have to talk about towards the end of this book, if the good guys make it out.
If.
Big if. So, all right. So then we come to the last one, and this is the hardest one, the priesthood one. Which character is the priest?
Okay.
It's also not actually hard.
Is it Frodo?
Yeah, it has to be Frodo. Frodo has to be one of these three, right? I mean, right, he's a ring bearer, right? So that's the thing, though. It's like, all right, by default, he gets this one.
Okay, but explain this a little bit.
Right. I definitely have to explain. Yeah, because here's the thing, too. Like, when I used to think of this, because I heard about this years ago before I even thought about doing some sort of Lord of the Rings podcast or whatnot, and I just thought, okay, well, Aragorn is clearly the king. Gandalf is clearly the prophet. So I guess Frodo's stuck with the priest, but he has to have one, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, how exactly is he a priest here? And I was thinking, is he like a medieval poor parish priest, you know, like where he just runs the little town and he's living in poverty, but he's serving the people as best he can and working with nothing? You know, I don't know. And so that kind of mildly works a little bit. But that's not the full extent at all. And then I also said at the beginning of this conversation, these are supposed to relate to the Old Testament, right? Mm-hmm. So then if we go biblically speaking, though, this actually becomes the most robust case, which is cool, which is why we're going to talk about this here. This is what we had to mention the other two, but what I mostly wanted to talk about was just the Frodo one. So,
okay.
So, because it's very applicable to this chapter and the next chapter and the whole quest. All right. So, yeah, we're going to talk about this because this, for all the reasons I said, but this is also really cool. And this is also stuff that any sort of person that claims to be a Christian, this is the kind of stuff you need to be able to connect or know, or, and most of us don't. So, I don't know. It's worth the trying to retell this. All right. So, first of all, biblical priesthood in the Old Testament. Excellent place to start would be the book of Leviticus. That's the Israelite priesthood. All right. So it was established through Moses' brother Aaron. I'm not going to try to quiz you on stuff here. But okay. So Leviticus, it gets the book gets its name because it's from there's the 12 tribes of Israel. Do you remember those? Mm-hmm. Or you won't remember by name. Like nobody can. No. But, the tribe of Levi is the one that Moses is from.
Okay.
And they get to become the priests for events that happen in Exodus. So then they just get the book of laws, priest laws, named after them. So they just call it Leviticus. Okay. Like Leviticus. All right. So then Moses is the head, but then his brother Aaron gets to be the high priest. And then the priesthood passes hereditarily through his kids. So through his sons, right?
Okay.
And so what's the big job of the priest, if you remember correctly?
Keep kind of like... keeping the holy knowledge in a way.
That's a good idea. Okay. reading the Old Testament, they like that comes and goes. Okay. quite waves. What's a bigger thing?
Leading the people.
Think of like delis.
Delis.
It's a good clue.
Feeding people. Killing people.
Killing people.
Killing animals.
Yes, they got to sacrifice the animals, right?
Okay, sacrificial offerings.
Yeah, okay. So these are the big...
Sacrificial,
yeah.
Meaning sacrifice, sacrament.
Oh, well, those are related for sure. But, okay. But so these people, they had to make all sorts of offerings to God as... There's all sorts of things, and they're pretty bizarre by everybody's modern standards. They're just weird. And then Jewish people today don't do them anymore for... Well, it's the reason they don't is because they don't have priests anymore, which that's a historical bigger conversation. Okay. All right. Anyways, we're going to talk about one sacrifice here really quick. The coolest one, and this one's actually cool. Like this is purely the reason I like to read Leviticus. Not that I sit down and read it often, but it's fun to read it just to get to this part. Once a year, this is the Yom Kippur holiday that's still around today, but they don't sacrifice animals anymore. So this is what they used to do. The priest, the high priest, he would take two goats, okay? In one, he would ritually sacrifice as usual, you know, as an offering to God and whatever, okay? Mm-hmm. The other one, all of Israel's present when he does this on this day. So, like, everybody would come to Jerusalem for this, okay? Mm-hmm. And what he would do is the priest would ceremonially, with all the people around, he would take... ceremonially transfer all of their sin and guilt of the whole people onto this one goat in order to make atonement for the people collectively as a whole for the year.
Okay.
And so it's like, that's what you do. That was one of the biggest things that you're doing with all these sacrifices, is you're making atonement for sins, or you're purifying yourself so that you can be in a better relationship with God. And it's like, did the act itself actually matter? No, besides that God prescribed it. So yes, it does matter now. Okay. And so this is the coolest one, because it's like, they put all the sins of the people on this goat, and it's, and then what do they do with the goat? They don't actually kill it like the other one. They just send it out into the wild and just let it wander and fall, like, die. Okay. I don't know. It just wastes away, right? Okay. But the sins of the people are transferred out of the community, right? Mm. And this is exactly where the term scapegoating comes from.
Okay? Oh, interesting.
Okay. Right. So that's the kind of cool thing is, usually, we said it in this episode, usually it's mutual hatred of somebody else. Uh-huh. This, they put it onto an innocent goat, which is kind of wild, okay? Mm. So that is definitely a step up to take it there. But this goat, it's like, all right, what did the goat do? Well, it's not human, so I don't actually care, right? Mm-hmm. that's kind of the reasoning there. And then they toss it out, right? And it's gone for the year. So keep that in mind. Other famous sacrifices in the Old Testament. To get into the human sacrifice realm, there's a famous test where God tests Abraham to sacrifice his only son, Isaac. Mm-hmm. You remember this story? Mm-hmm. So Abraham's actually willing to do it, which is hard to believe and crazy and scary, right? Mm-hmm. But at the last second, it stopped. But as this was going on, Isaac had asked his dad, you know, because they're setting up the sacrifice. He's just like, where's the lamb to sacrifice to God? And Abraham had prophetically answered, God will provide the lamb, .. Because it was supposed to be the firstborn son, Isaac. But then God said, no, but God will provide the lamb, .. Still holds up, okay? So the most famous sacrifice in all the Old Testament has to come in Exodus, right? Where 10 plagues Egypt, right? So the people are enslaved. They're trying to get out of Egypt. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. You know, it's Moses versus Pharaoh stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the 10 plagues come. The 10th plague, do you remember the 10th plague?
That's the they have to paint the blood on the door to indicate that it's a Jewish household.
Yeah. Well, it does not even do it, indicate that it's a Jewish household. It's only the Hebrew Jewish people that will do it.
Okay.
Because well, so the reasoning on that is because none of the Egyptians would do it because they worshipped the lamb. And so it was kind of gross to sacrifice it and
put it
up there.
Okay. The Egyptians didn't want to sacrifice the lamb because they kind of worshipped the lambs.
Right. So that was one of the many things that they would worship. Okay. Uh-huh. Anyways, the reason they had to put the lamb's blood up there was because this 10th plague was anybody that didn't have the lamb's blood on the door, the plague was going to literally just kill their firstborn son, right? Mm-hmm. So you had to sacrifice this lamb, put the blood on the door so that you avoid that. And so all the Hebrews did it. The Egyptians didn't. All their firstborn sons were killed. Hebrews get to live, and they commemorate it with the festival of Passover every year. Like the Passover was the plague passed over their door, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So fast forward all the way to the New Testament, to Holy Week, to the Last Supper. Jesus, on Passover, he's instituting a kind of new priesthood. The Old Testament priesthood was based on Aaron's family line, Moses' brother Aaron. Now, Jesus is instituting a new priesthood where he himself is going to be the high priest, and he's going to be the sacrifice itself. Okay.
Okay. Interesting.
So, and that's what we celebrate at every Mass. You know, we eat the body of Christ, mm-hmm. body and blood. We're symbolizing and reenacting that sacrifice that happened on the cross. So like on Good Friday, that's what we're doing every time we have that. Like that's what we're commemorating, celebrating. Well, yeah. So okay. Historically, the one on the cross was an event that happened in history, and that opens the gates to heaven. But then now we commemorate it once a week, you know, because it's such a big deal and everything. When Christ died on the cross, you know, to tie this all back together to the two things that we just said, Jesus was God's firstborn son. And that's not like he had other sons. That's like reference to Egypt, okay? Where, you know, this plague killed the firstborn son. Hmm. Isaac was the firstborn son of Abraham. And so God didn't actually make the Hebrews go through with offering their firstborn son to him. But out of his love, he did offer his firstborn son to redeem all of humanity. You know, so that's a big, he asked some people, he didn't quite ask some people to do that sacrifice, but it was a sacrifice that he himself did give to us, which is big deal, something to think about, you know. But the crucifixion itself, that gets into this, right? The way of the cross, you've heard of Stations of the Cross, everything about the Passion, Mel Gibson's movie, pretty excellent, pretty damn gory, right? So if you watch that whole movie too, like that is one thing. Whenever I watch that movie, I just think, man, why does it keep falling? Let's just get there. I mean, you just gotta save up your strength and just keep going. Like, let's get this done as quick as possible, you know, because this is so brutal. Mm-hmm. Because he's getting, you know, he's on his way to get crucified and executed. So, exhausting, isolating, scary, sorrowful. And he's not even just a sacrifice. Tie this back to the Leviticus thing. Jesus is being the scapegoat himself, you know? Like, when he's carrying the cross, he's bearing kind of everybody's sins and the weight of the world, you know, on it. Uh-huh. Symbolically, but then also somehow literally, like, you know, it's above my pay grade to be able to understand that. that's what he's doing. And he's taking evil on himself. And how's he doing it? Freely, innocently. And, you know, it's just, he is the innocent person. It's almost as if he's swallowing evil, just absorbing it.
Okay.
You know, to where it has no power. Like, if I'm going to freely sacrifice myself in this manner, then evil is going to have no power over me. I'm going to take all the evil and injustice on myself, everybody's sins ever. And then I'm going to defeat evil because I'm going to come back to life. You know? It's like, and that's going to be a sign for everybody else that this is what's going to happen. And that, you know, there's something to look forward to beyond sin and death, basically. Tie this back to Lord of the Rings. The priest one to Frodo becomes insanely simple, I would say, right?
Okay.
So, fair enough. all the way down to the fellowship setting out from Rivendell, they set out on December 25th. Obviously, Jesus was born into the world on December 25th, right? So he starts his mission towards the cross on December 25th. So does Frodo, right? Towards Mordor. Fast forward to the Passion and then even like the breaking of the fellowship. I almost think like with Frodo and Sam's story, he's almost giving like an extended narrative of like the Stations of the Cross. You know, it's just chapters and chapters long. And what he's doing is he's showing Frodo's passion as he sets out east, besides the Faramir chapters. Like, those don't quite fit in. But
right. But
he's setting Frodo's journey out east. It's helping to better explain what Jesus was going through. You know, and this is exactly where it kind of fits, where Tolkien said, oh, Lord of the Rings is implicitly Catholic at first, but then in the revision it's explicitly Catholic. It's like, well, this is what he's trying to literally convey to the readers and better help them understand and tune with, you know. Even if they never hear any sort of podcast that talks about that or read any book that talks about that, it's you start to understand that a little bit as you read it, whether you realize it or not, you know. Like, the Old Testament stuff points to that Jesus story too, like what's happening in the Passion itself. And there's other myths in the ancient world that do too, and we tried to kind of cover that with the True Myth special that we did. You know, like, it all points to understanding what happened in Jesus's Passion, right? That's what we're trying to make sense of, and these are the kind of things that help you do it. And like, yeah, Tolkien ends up writing Lord of the Rings, very entertaining historic great book. and this is part of what he's like motivating him and doing it for, right? Because the ring, most evil thing in the world, someone good, someone innocent must bear up this evil and take it upon himself for the good of everyone else. Obviously, that's exactly what Frodo's doing, and he's got to go to the very depth and core of evil to destroy it, you know. And so, like, it's not, that's why we have to go all the way to Mordor, you know. And think about it too. Like, you can get a big victory at Minas Tirith, but that's not good enough. And it's just like, think about any sort of evil or any sort of like personal sin or something that you've done. You have to really get rid of it. You got to go all the way down. You can't just half-ass something, right? If you want to break like a bad habit, you got to totally rooted out completely, you know, and that's what he's doing. That's what they're doing too with evil in this case. Gandalf's also said that evil's not going to be totally destroyed, but it's going to be about as destroyed as they could for their generation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So.
Okay, I buy the priest analogy. Frodo is priest.
Yeah. So, I have a little bit more to say on the priest thing, but we can save it for the next week.
Okay.
But the loose end to all this, if Frodo's the priest and the sacrifice, how does Sam fit into everything?
Sam is...
We can save that for another time.
Okay, stay tuned.
All right, that's all I got.
Thanks, y'all.